It was a reminder that the world needs ideas. In a way, this is the opposite of Brodsky's idea. You have to remember that you're insignificant, but also that you are potentially more significant than all the noise that's being supplied to you at every moment. This is my commencement address to you.
Graduates, class of now. As you enter a world that will be increasingly filled with links and apps, take some time to be bored. Take some time to navigate both distraction and boredom. Take time to make time. Now, go forth into the world.
I wish it was a little cooler today. This robe they made me wear is hot. Widen your circle. But say you've tried all these things and nothing has worked. Say you put your nose to the grindstone and all you're getting is a sore nose. When that used to happen to me, I didn't know where to turn. This feeling could creep up on me that was something like desperation. I had tried everything I knew to try, and I was still coming up empty. But as I've gone further into my career, I've seen that there's one great option still available. Here it is. If you're feeling like things aren't going anywhere, and you know the feeling, stalled, lost, paralyzed, a little desperate, can't keep food down, long walks at night, make a point of hanging out with people from different disciplines. When I started working in the food business, or rather, working around the food business, I liked talking to chefs. I briefly had a restaurant called Hybrid in Chelsea Market. But more lastingly, I've been hosting a series of food salons in Manhattan. I pick chefs from some of the country's best restaurants to cook at my salons. Some of them come from other countries, actually. Maddie Matheson came down from Canada. And we had people who worked in London, France, and Tokyo as well. The afternoon before they cook, they sit around and talk, sometimes to me, sometimes to each other. I started to like listening to their conversation, and I profited from it. At first, it was just normal enjoyment. I like hearing people use different verbs and nouns who all seem to have a similar set of experiences. But after a little while, the part of my brain that subjects everything to analysis kicked in. And I started to notice that they were acting their way through a different set of creative stimuli and responses. That led to a long-term interest in the way that chefs function as creative professionals. The biggest difference, obviously, is in the relationship with their audience. Musicians have audiences making demands on them, but not in the pure sense. You see, if the Roots don't drop an album tomorrow or next week, no one suffers. Chefs are supplying a creative product that is also a survival product. When it's time for dinner, people open their mouths, and it's necessary to put something in there. Chefs don't have the luxury of not delivering ideas. As a result, they have, over time, devised a number of strategies for shaking up their creativity when they feel like a stall is coming. Sometimes they do versions of things I've already talked about. They try to copy an existing dish down to the last molecule, or else they'll line up a set of ingredients, pick one, and go from there. Or they limit their time or their kitchen tools. Or they cook with only one hand. They're expert at various cooking show tricks and stunts, but turn toward their own ends. But the other thing they do is shake it up. They go elsewhere. And elsewhere isn't where you think. When I first overheard these chefs talk about their own excursions, I thought they were kidding. One chef, who I won't name, was talking about his highly acclaimed New York restaurant. "One day I was trying to think of a new menu," he said, "and I was just fried. I couldn't think of how to put it together, let alone how to take it apart and put it together in a way that would move things forward. So you know what I did?" The other chefs didn't know. They just said so. He paused for effect. "I went to a Chinese buffet." People laughed. But he was dead serious. "Listen," he said, "I know it sounds stupid, but that's a place where you have a million trays and a million ingredients, and someone is thinking about how to order them, even if they're thinking about it in a way that we don't normally value. There are visual choices. Do you cluster all the green vegetables? There are narrative choices. What if you notice that people are spending too much time at the hard-boiled egg tray, and that's interfering with the spinach tray right next to it? There are utensil choices. Maybe you thought a spoon would be better for the chicken pieces. but maybe tongs are a better solution. The other chefs were starting to get into it. Yes, one of them said. I have a similar habit, though I don't do it with food. I go to these giant candy stores. I'm fascinated by how they let you see so many things at the same time. They all started talking excitedly about the places they went to think when they couldn't think in their own place. I had to leave that conversation pretty early that day, but I started asking other chefs about this idea. The answers I got were surprising, in a sense that they advanced this theory. Ludo Lefebvre at Trois Mecs told me that he goes to McDonald's because he loves their French fries. They give him inspiration. What do you mean, I said. He started to explain, then stopped, then started, then stopped again. I don't know if I can be very clear about it, he said. But they are doing something, and doing it well. If I see it up close, I can understand it, or at least absorb a sense of it. He didn't need to be very clear about it. I understood what he meant. It's motivation. I feel the same way when I listen to an especially good superficial pop song, even if it's nothing I would ever try. But the takeaway here isn't necessarily to depart from your comfort zone to spark your creativity as much as it is to be around people who are discussing the process of having done that. Elsewhere, I've talked about woodshedding and how artists in different creative disciplines brainstorm. This isn't exactly the same thing, but it's related. Comedians, for example, are famous for hanging out backstage, not necessarily trying out material on each other, but just working through the process of being a comedian in the presence of other comedians. In January 2017, the night Michelle Obama was a guest on The Tonight Show and her final late-night TV appearance as the First Lady, there was a surprise show later that night at the Comedy Cellar. It started out as a show by Dave Attell, and then Jerry Seinfeld performed. And then one by one, other comedians came out on stage. Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Amy Schumer, Aziz Ansari. I was there, and I was around them all backstage, watching them interact. Like the chefs, the comedians had their own unique shorthand when they spoke to each other. Sometimes the point was to make each other laugh. Sometimes the point was to get rid of the butterflies. Sometimes the point was woodshedding, trying out material before it was ready for a larger venue or a more polished destination. That was the point for them. For me, though, it was watching the process as it unfolded. It was amazingly liberating. I feel the same way on weeks where I hang out around Saturday Night Live. Tuesday and Wednesday are big days because those are the pitch meetings to try to figure out the makeup of the show. For the writers, I'm sure it's a series of minor heart attacks around the mechanics of trying to make a sketch work in the context of the largest show. For me, it's like the best, most rewarding vacation ever. I get to see how things work when other people are working. Whenever I've done that, I feel creatively rejuvenated. Keep your comforts close. Not too long ago, I was listening to a podcast on the edge of sleep. The guest was Seth Rogen, comedian and actor. Rogan was talking about how he got started and what kind of comedy he preferred and how he learned to take risks, many of the same things that I've been talking about in this book. He also talked about something very different from what I talk about, drugs, and his lifelong interest in them. He started smoking pot and taking mushrooms with his friends when he was a young teen, 13 or 14. He had continued using drugs in one form or another throughout his adult life. As a kid, they were useful because they helped him deal with his social anxiety, which he realized was not simple anxiety, but a kind of enhanced sensitivity to the environment around him. That was the same set of skills that let him observe things and become a good comedian. So it was important for him to find some sort of way to keep it controlled and focused rather than let it control him. As he became older, he became a professional comedian and a comic actor. He noticed a shift in the way people used drugs and the way that drugs affected them. On film sets or in comedy clubs, he noticed that some people reacted to getting high in ways that separated them from the work that they were doing. They fell inside themselves, or became unnaturally attuned to everything that was going on around them. The drugs didn't work to their advantage. For him, he said, they were something different. They continued to be a source of relaxation and a way of producing comfort. They could give him a feeling of well-being that kept him profitably connected to the work he was doing. Sometimes he didn't use during movie shoots because he was nervous about how a director or a co-star might react. But he didn't think for a moment that drugs themselves were interfering with his ability to work. He even made a joke about his tolerance and how he could smoke with friends and they'd be out of commission and he'd be no more affected than if he had just had a glass of water. I already knew that different people reacted differently to drugs. I've been backstage with musicians. I've seen the ones who could barely stand right next to the ones who seemed like they could still do their taxes and not miss a penny. But there was one thing that Rogan said that really stuck with me. He said he had worked with actors who purposely decided not to take drugs while they were working. They worried that it would be unprofessional or that it would incapacitate them somehow. Those actors, he said, spent their entire work days not wanting to be on set because they wanted to head home so they could light up a joint. They would have been better served if they had permitted themselves drugs on set because it would have kept them in their work. Otherwise, they were separating the idea of comfort and pleasure from the idea of creative work, and that resulted in a kind of split state where they were never really engaged in their acting. Rogan, because he's smart and thoughtful, wanted to discuss how many an actor who felt uncomfortable could achieve certain depths in a performance that might not otherwise be available. But I didn't go on with him in his analysis. I was still stopped at the moment where he said that those actors who resolved to not get high on set were keeping themselves away from their happiness. Extend that argument into a more general creative work. Let's say you like exercise. Let's say you like eating. Let's say you like listening to music. Let's say you like hearing the voices of other people. Let's say you like being inside. Let's say you like being outside. Let's say you like wearing fuzzy slippers. Whatever your personal preference, no matter how significant or how trivial, if it's a source of pleasure, and in denying yourself that pleasure, you'll be entering a state where you think about it all the time. Then you're working against your own creativity. You might think certain things are a distraction, but going without them can be a larger distraction if you're thinking all the time about the time when you will be returned to them, or them to you. That was an interesting and lasting insight, and it leads to a kind of rule. Make your environment reflective of your tastes. Eliminate distractions, including the distraction of being without any of the distractions you need. I want to thank Seth Rogen for this insight. I also want to use this opportunity to clear up the pick controversy. All right, a few months after I heard the interview with Seth, he went on social media and posted a picture of himself. Well, it wasn't just of himself. It was of himself standing next to a framed Afro pick that he had taken from me when he was a guest on The Tonight Show. People got angry at him for all types of reasons. That it was cultural appropriation, that he was turning a historically significant artifact into a souvenir, that it was uncool to make a Questlove museum as if I were somehow an object of curiosity. I posted right back at Seth to let him know that it was all fine with me. I even included a picture of the bucket in my dressing room that contains dozens and dozens and dozens of pics that are identical to the ones he took. The dust-up was not all that dusty, and it was over. Hey, Seth, the second I release my AfroPic line, I'll send you a case for your collection. When I did give it a few seconds of thought, I realized that the non-controversy reinforced the point Seth made on the podcast. If playful, affectionate pranks are your wheelhouse, stay in that wheelhouse. Don't let people make you feel that you're something that you're not, or else you'll get in your own way. Unblock Party. When you're having trouble thinking of new ideas, go to one of your old ideas and rework it. Curation as cure. wired brain. I remember reading about Leonardo da Vinci. I was in Germany with the Roots, where our manager, Rich, had taken us so that we could get established as a cutting-edge American hip-hop band over in Europe before returning triumphantly to America and claiming the fame that was rightfully ours. It was a strategy. And though it didn't work as perfectly as Rich made it sound like it would, it wasn't a total bust either. We came back. We had a reputation. The rest was history. Assuming that by history you mean another 15 years of hard work and a steady climb into the public's consciousness. Back in Germany, we were at a restaurant, and someone had left a biography of Leonardo on the table. I didn't read much of it, maybe a page or two. But I remember the cover art. There's a picture of Leonardo that everyone knows. The Rick Rubin one with the big beard and hat. The main thing I remember was thinking about how different his world was from mine. He was incredibly learned, versed in art and science, but his world was more limited. He spent most of his life in Italy and France and went to other countries occasionally. But there were giant parts of the world that he'd never saw or even knew about. This wasn't a bad thing, obviously. He was able to focus and think and create. Leonardo died in 1519. 500 years later, it's a completely different world. We have access to almost everything. I'm not speaking in terms of a human network. We have access to other people, but they still have to be cultivated. You still have to put in time to make connections with individuals who matter to you. But there's an impersonal version of it, the internet, that makes it all too easy to find anyone and find out anything. Any time of day or night, I can take my computer or, increasingly, my phone and look up anything. I could read a newspaper from almost anywhere in the world. I can read yesterday's news and last year's news, too. I never have to be without the definition of a word, which is discountenancing, disturbing in a way that changes the expression on your face. I never have to wonder about the population of the United States, 325 million and counting, according to the Census Bureau's population clock. What this means, of course, is that our brains are changing. They used to be containers. Now, they're retrievers. It's a fundamental shift. I remember reading an article somewhere that explained how humans, as a species, are starting to use the internet and the cloud as a kind of external hard drive for our consciousness. The article said that it wasn't just that technology made these things possible. It made us dependent on those things. I don't remember where I read it, but I can look it up. Okay, got it. Scientific American, from December 2013. The entire expedition to find that out took about 30 seconds. The real Leonardo couldn't have gotten his pens and ink ready to start a sketch of the flying machine in that amount of time. Lots of people have written lots of articles about the effect of the internet on the human brain. Container versus retriever is only one of the things that are changing. We're also better able to multitask, but less able to engage in the kind of task-free meditation that can help make tasks more pleasant when we do perform them. We're constantly bombarded with side rails and related links, which means that distraction is both more of a threat than ever and also something a little different than it's been before. If someone pushes you to a related link, and it's actually related, is that a distraction or is it some kind of supplement? These are all important issues. I've looked into some of them at other points in the book. Distraction is an especially interesting one. I'd ask you to flip through the book and try to find the other places where I discussed it, but that would be more of an illustration of the principle than a helpful piece of advice. And also, you can't because it's an audiobook. Here, though, I want to talk more about the specific ways in which technology changes creativity. I said Leonardo's world was completely different than the world I was living in when I picked up his biography in Germany in the early 90s. But the world now, 25 years after I read that biography, is completely different all over again. The first and most obvious effect is that technology drives a stake in the heart of originality. I talked about originality before in the chapter about getting started with your creative day, and about how certain kinds of imitation can give a much-needed jumpstart at the beginning of your day. But they also drain the battery. At the Tonight Show, I get to interact with a variety of comedians. When we first started on late night, Twitter was just a baby. After a few years, it grew up, and I started to see that comedians were using it as a platform to test out and shape jokes. Then there was a turn where they noticed that everyone else was doing the same thing. When Ryan Lochte got caught with his pants down, not literally, but in the not telling the truth about something sense, jokes were all over the internet within seconds. People who weren't comedians but were funny or lucky or persistent went down the same avenues of exploration and sometimes hit on the same exact setups and punchlines. The first person to make a joke somehow claimed ownership. The second had to make an excuse, even when there wasn't a reason to make an excuse. Media critics and psychologists started to talk about parallel thinking, the theory that if you put a million people on the same path, some of them will end up at exactly the same destination. All this made the comedians I knew start to back up from the medium. Sometimes they wouldn't read Twitter because they wanted to preserve their own process, keep their heads clear. Sometimes it was for reputation purposes. They didn't want to be seen as joke thieves. One year at Edinburgh Fringe Festival, a comedian named Darren Walsh performed a bit about deleting all the German names from his contact list so that his phone was Hans-free. He won a prize for it. But then another comedian named Pete Cunningham said that he had tweeted it years before and that he knew that Walsh had seen it because they corresponded about it. And it turned out to be true. There was evidence. The result, of course, has been to change the face of comedy. The growth of the internet was accompanied by the growth of alt comedy, where the issue wasn't the jokes you told, but the way you told them. Your stage presence, your performance, the perspective you carved out, your entire persona. At some level, this is just an industry story, but in other ways, it's an important metaphor for how technology is shifting the terms of creativity. I have another example, not from comedy, though from something comic. Weekly newspaper headline writing. My co-writer, Ben Greenman, used to work for newspapers and magazines. One of his early jobs was writing headlines for a paper in Miami called The New Times. It was a weekly paper, and Ben tried hard to come up with the best headlines for his articles. When he wrote a movie review of Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, his headline was, "Boise will be Boise." When he wrote an article about a pair of hot dog cart owners competing for a busy corner in downtown Miami, his headline was, "Wiener Take All." He thought of both of those jokes himself, late at night with caffeine. Today, Boise Will Be Boise has more than 1,000 hits on Google. Wiener Take All has more than 3,000. When we were writing this section, he told me one of his puns had survived unscathed. When he wrote about Awakenings, the medical drama based on Oliver Sacks' book, starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro, his headline was, "Mort and MD." That doesn't turn up anywhere else in Google, as best as I can tell. Okay, I admit it, I didn't Google them. Ben did. It's a little self-absorbed, but I can't completely blame him. We were working on this section of the book. It's relevant. But the fact of the matter is that originality doesn't mean what it once did. Parallel thinking is real, but so is the sinking feeling of seeing your idea paralleled somewhere else. I want to suggest a remedy. Creative people need to start thinking of themselves a little differently. Now, in the 21st century, creative life also includes some management of other people's creativity and the overlap between yours and theirs. To put it a different way, you can be an artist, but you also have to be a curator. You have to occupy both of these roles at the same time. Think of your creative choices as if you were curating an art exhibit. Some of your ideas or influences immediately go on display. They become part of the version of yourself that you present to the outside world. Others are waiting for similar things to become a useful group, after which they can be displayed. And then there are the pieces of information or experiences that go into storage. You know that they're helping you build your own collection, but they aren't there for others, at least not yet. Creative people take in more than the average person, or rather, they are less able to shut out parts of their environment. In the modern world, that's an even more intense problem because so much information, so many signals flow across our brains. Bjork has come to my food salons. She was the earliest person to arrive one night, and I was scared to death to talk too much to her. She had an otherworldly aura about her, even in person. Even though one of my guests was on the street with her afterward, getting a cab, and said that she was very down-to-earth and normal. I spoke to her briefly and listened in on one of the other conversations she was having. It confirmed my theory that the most creative people are both making things and curating them. Let's go back for a second to the idea of cognitive disinhibition. I've had conversations about the way she's integrated science into her work, especially biology. She knows more about biology than the average person, but it's not on display. Sometimes it's in the back, in the warehouse, waiting on a future exhibit. Curation also gives you a lens through which you can see the rest of the world. If you're working on a novel about how technology is changing people's interaction with each other, you'll be able to pass through each day actively watching and listening, because you know in the back of your head that you're working toward that project. You're hanging that show. I've learned that from my comedian friends, people like Neil Brennan. They get material from the existing in the world, from sharp observations, but they're looking within a framework. Curation also teaches you principles of display. You hang things on the wall next to each other, in your mind. And when you do, pay special attention to what they're saying to each other, again, in your mind. Height on the wall matters. Size matters. Order matters. When you have multiple pieces of an idea, they communicate with each other in various ways. There's a presiding metaphor here of assembling an art show, but I want to shift it for a second into something that I'm more familiar with, which is DJ sets. For years, I have done two main jobs. The first one is to drum for the Roots, but I'm also a DJ, which means what you think it means. After we're done playing our set, I go to nightclubs, or sometimes stay at the same club, to play music for a crowd. There are older-fashioned versions of this that involve two turntables and vinyl, and there are new versions that involve a laptop and a playlist. In either situation, the goal is the same, to get people moving. And not in a herky-jerky way or a kitschy way or a hyperactive way. It's not all just about playing CNC Music Factory on volume 1 million. It's a different enterprise. You want the crowd to be moved spiritually and psychologically and physically all at the same time. And for an idea to start to form around the idea of that movement. You're thinking about people and how they are affected by music. When I look out over a room, I'm figuring out how the third song will hit them. Maybe a little sideways if I do it right. And then I'll schedule the fourth song to move a little higher in their energy cylinders. And then a fifth will bring them back down. It's a process described at some length by Eric B. and Rakim in Move the Crowd. So leave it up to me. My DJ is mixing. Everybody's moving or eager to listen. And yet, when you're playing a DJ set, you're not exactly making anything. You're contending with work that other people have already made, reorganizing, repurposing it. It's creation in the sense that I'm bringing a mood into existence. But it's curation in the sense that I'm looking through existing songs to see which ones I'm going to select. It's also a chance to wonder about the psychological effects of music, how people react to it. I always find that one couple where the husband wants to leave, and the wife wants to stay for just one more song. I just laugh because I know what I'm playing next. And I know it will seem like a letdown or a curveball. See, that's easy to have a captive audience playing the hits like that. Psh, that's 101. It's so much more amazing to watch them try to figure out why you're playing Kermit the Frog. All right, let me give you an example. Sometimes I'll troll the audience in using the Golden Girls theme. It's not really punking them, to be completely honest. It's experimenting on them. And the experiment isn't just on the nostalgic theme song from an old sitcom, or that the original was a hit in April of 1978, the same month that Prince released his first album. It's something more than that. I want to see how a group of people engaged in nighttime activities like drinking, dancing, and assorted other whatnot respond to the sound the television would be making if they had decided not to go out at all that night. I'm creating a night that sounds like staying in. There's another experiment I do. Late in the set, as people are getting worn out, I'll downshift to a slower song. But it's not just any slower song. Phil Collins, In the Air Tonight. Everyone knows the song, but think of how it starts. Daryl Sturmer, who played guitar with George Duke, playing that buzzing chord, and Phil Collins layering up keyboards and drums. But the moment everyone knows is later, when the crashing rubbery drums come in. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Collins got the effect by playing while the talkback circuit was still activated. It's the technique I outlined in an earlier chapter, being open to the possibility that accidents might be better than the plan. And then Hugh Padgham, his co-producer, recorded it using compressed and gated microphones. It's the sound that drives the audience crazy. The modern version is Can't Stop, Won't Stop from Philly's own Young Guns, a song just as sparse and minimal, and then just as loud and devastating. It uses the same elements, a Roland CR78 for quiet effect, and then reverb rolls for powerful impact. When I play In the Air Tonight in a DJ set, I can see everyone tensing up, waiting for it. And just as the song gets to that moment, I switch to the other song. You should see their faces. Go take a look at your face in the mirror right now. It's like that, but times a million. And all the other times I've used that song in my DJ sets couldn't have prepared me for the moment in October 2016 when Collins himself, promoting his memoir, came to the Tonight Show and performed In the Air Tonight. Guess who got to do that drum part? That's right. The two examples I outline are planned stunts. They're like magic tricks. Other times, though, DJ sets are an opportunity for spontaneity. If the mood of the crowd seems too mellow, I might hit them with the burst of Eric B. and Rakim or Playboi Carti, depending on their age. If they seem too close in on one another, I might create some space, like with Kraftwerk or Rare Earth or Kojo Funds or Gavin Turek. Those create a different kind of arrangement on the floor. I'm improvising. But I'm actually curating. I'm using what I know about existing artworks to arrange them in such a way that they affect the audience. Or to quote Parliament, the desired effect is what you get. I think of something else Bjork said. This wasn't at my food salon. It was in her interview with Herman Vasky on German television. He asks her whether her creativity depends more on discipline or chaos. She gives an answer that explains how her creation is always part of the process, even for an artist who depends so much on capturing moments of oddness and whim. She says, "Right now, my discipline seems to be mostly when I arrange music or when I'm doing collecting libraries of beats. The studio process is very disciplined and very focused. My voice and songwriting is sort of the opposite. I would never let the analytical side of me in there. It could be very destructive." This answer really struck a chord with me. That idea of collecting libraries of beats is something that many musicians do. As a DJ, though, I take it a step further. I collect libraries of songs. I have terabytes of hard drive space devoted to hundreds of thousands of songs. And as time goes on, as technical standards change, I have to monitor it and improve it. I have to curate it. Around the first of this year, I decided that one of my goals was to get rid of 200 gigabytes of doubles and triples of songs that I no longer needed. That means goodbye to all the Jodeci songs that are on both Greatest Hits collections and on regular albums. That means goodbye to all the redundant copies of Run-DMC's Tricky from soundtracks and compilations. All I want is the original version from Raising Hell. And why exactly do I have 8 copies of Crazy in Love? On the other hand, all the various permutations of Michael Jackson's wannabe starting something, the 7-inch edit, the 12-inch, demos 1, 2, and 3, and the regular album release are essential for collecting. Obviously, I want to keep the highest quality. I'm up to AIFF standard now, which chews up tremendous amount of space, and I want to make sure that I don't accidentally get rid of the 12-inch version or a rare 7-inch edit. Maintaining the collection defines most of my days. When I wake up in the morning, I spend about 2 hours scaling down and cataloging. I'm shazamming all the Tidalist Track 1 files in my collection, almost 900 at the moment. When I go to bed at night, it's the same. Maybe this makes me the cat lady of music. I don't know. What I do know is that some nights I fall asleep in a chair and wake up with my computer on my lap, still playing. It's not terrifically exciting pursuit in some ways, but it's vital in others. It's a form of gardening, maybe. Is that a better metaphor? To end up with beautiful flowers and healthy plants, you have to be in regular contact with them. You have to prune. You have to tend. That's the duty of the curator. In my guise as a DJ, there's a real benefit to it. But I think it's creatively vital as well. This brings me back to the Bjork quote. Sometimes you want to be spontaneous. Sometimes you want to embrace chaos. But in a world where there's so much other stuff being made, where your responsibility is at least partially to process and arrange it before you go on and add to it, it's vitally important to locate, and hopefully love, your brand of curation. Curatorial thinking. Right when I was starting this book, in September 2016, Twitter had an Ask a Curator hashtag in conjunction with a day-long program of bringing actual museum curators before the public. Mostly, they were from brick-and-mortar museums, art museums, natural history museums, specialty museums. I followed along a little bit through the day, then wrote parallel questions to help people ask questions of their own internal curators. Here are some of the real questions, and then, in brackets, my own Questlovian versions. What object most reflects your community's heritage? My version? What creative project that you've worked on reflects your own cultural heritage? What objects do you have in your personal collection? My version? Which of your own works would you buy first if you were a consumer? What's the smallest object in your collection? My version. What's the smallest idea you ever had, and did you record it in some way? When you think like a curator, you're already thinking about how to take other creative choices that other people made and arrange them to your advantage. Curation can be seen as a way of seeing through to the parts of things that matter to you. It's like a large-scale, immersive version of cut-up writing. You're collecting things to help you remind you of who you are. But curation isn't only about arranging. It's not just about what goes on top and what goes underneath. What goes near the entrance and what goes near the exit. That's part of it, of course. And if you're losing the metaphor, back up a section. But a big part is what's in the show at all. Curation is inseparable from the process of selection. And selection is inseparable from the opposite of selection, discarding. It's an echo of that David Byrne thought. Before you decide what kind of artist you are, you have to decide what kind of artist you're not. There's a parallel process that's just as important and a little easier, which is deciding what kind of art you care about and what kind of art you don't care about. Curators do it every day. You should too. I used to think that I should have an opinion about everything. I listened to albums, and every time I had a reaction. But then one afternoon, I was in a band dressing room at the Tonight Show, and in the outer room, someone was playing a top pop album by a major star. I won't say which one, but it doesn't matter. It sounded fine to me, pleasant enough. But I realized that I had no real opinion about it. I had nothing to say about it. Positive or negative. If I weighed in, it would only been talking the talk, not feeling anything or thinking any thought. It left me entirely blank. And that was okay. It wasn't the artist's fault. There was no fault involved on any side of the issue. The artist had created something, and it was something that passed me by. It was a strange sensation to be freed from that obligation of having to say anything about this record. It was liberating not to feel the pressure to have an opinion. How would that work as a curator? It's almost alarmingly simple. The album's not in my show. Maybe there comes a time later where I start researching how that particular artist evolved. Maybe there comes a time later where I develop an interest in certain kinds of synthetic beats. But that has to happen organically. At that moment in 2015, I was a curator who would not hang that album on the walls of the museum of my mind. In other words, you need to understand your own curated set of creative impulses in that way. Don't be surprised when you find yourself favoring some of them over others. Be pleased. Again, this is not intended to say anything negative about a pop star and his or her record. It's intended to say nothing about the album. Nothing at all. But to stress that the album should only matter to, should only be curated by, people who feel a connection to it. You have to throw things away so that there is some value implied by the act of keeping other things. The pick. When you curate, you select. You're making a pick. More to the point, you're making the pick. The cover of my memoir, Mo Meta Blues, was based on the famous Milton Glaser poster of Bob Dylan, which was in turn inspired by Marcel Duchamp's famous 1957 self-portrait. Inspiration can come from anywhere, and should. Dylan's hair was a riot of ideas. Mine was too, with one important difference. My pick. It's a black thing. And a black hair thing. And as Seth Rogen discovered, it's a perfect way to start your own personal Questlove collection. But there was one other reason, too. I think of the pick almost as a staple, holding those unruly ideas in place. The pick is a foundational part of modern creativity. It is what happens. You put your hand on something, and it becomes part of your creative profile. But pay attention to the specifics about how it happens. Curation, in the modern sense, even though it builds the self, is slightly impersonal. When you go see a show, it was painstakingly put together by one creative talent, who assembled works from other creative talents. But except in rare occasions, the curator doesn't get anything close to a byline. The primary identity of the group of works is the name of the show that the curator has attached to it. Looked at from a slight remove, then, curation can be seen as a form of assuming a persona. You assemble a version of your creative interests, the works that inspire strong responses, and then you put that version forward. Other people come and see those works, and through them they understand something about you. That's how you should function with regards to facts, with regards to works. Ultimately, you're working toward a time when you can function that way with regard to your own works. Some things you make get shelved. Some get hung next to other things. The recombination principles at work, reduce, reuse, recycle, continue to apply. You're both present and absent. You are both in the moment and out of the moment. This is another version of taking a beat. In the first chapter, I talked about how taking a beat via micro-meditation is important when you first think of an idea. We're in a world that's loaded up with things to think about, but the beat is just as important here. Hang back from your own work. Decide how much you need it at the moment, how much you might need it later. That step back lets you step forward into other work. Notice when you notice. In an earlier chapter, we talked about managing your network to your advantage. Then, we talked about setting up your show, in which you internally hang all the works that you need to move forward creatively. Setting up the show required you to learn the art of the pick, the talent of knowing which parts of the world to filter out. But once you're done, once the show is assembled, once the little title cards have been typed out and affixed to the wall, then you have to learn how to move through it and make the most of what you see. On a podcast, I heard the comedian Kate Micucci talking about how when she was young, an aspiring visual artist, she used to go to museums often. She says something about standing in front of paintings. She says she didn't give them all the same amount of time. How could she? That's not how you visit a museum. Stand in front of work one, count to 20. Stand in front of work two, count to 20. Repeat until dissatisfied. No, you should go through a museum at a clip until something demands your attention. Keep on the move until you're asked by work to stop moving. Here, the only metaphor I can think of is the way that people walked in early Spike Lee movies. Remember his glory days? Spike would put actors on a rolling dolly with the camera shooting up from below and pull them along the street. The story on screen suggested that the characters were walking, usually through Brooklyn, but it would look like they were gliding. Once you set up your works, once you wrapped up the curation phase, move with steady smoothness. At some point, something will speak to you. I mean this metaphorically. If one of your ideas in your head actually speaks to you, you might not be getting enough sleep. When it speaks to you, reward it. Give it a minute. A minute might sound short, but it's not. Try looking at something and studying it intently for a whole minute. That's pretty taxing. This is another hint about the modern world. Slow time down. I mentioned micro-meditations, how you need to step back from moments of crisis to collect yourself. This is true even when there's not a crisis. The world is filled with so many signals and so much more noise. And simple concentration on something that you already have selected is something that's more valuable than you can ever imagine. Someone brought me the game Quinto once. I read the instructions, grasped them, and then really never played. The board stayed on the table with some kind of art object, a futuristic chess-type thing. And then one day I was not quite working on something and half staring at the Quinto board, and I just zoned out. But I don't really zone out. I zoned into it. I started looking at the pieces and seeing what I intellectually already understood to be there. Some cylindrical, some squared off, some taller, some shorter, some of lighter wood, some of darker, some with an open top, some closed. That opened up drastically, just for a moment, into a set of ideas that had to do with Black Lives Matter, Sly Stone's Everyday People, Blade Runner, and old cigarette ads I remember from my childhood. And just like that, they were gone. The whole thing took a minute at most. Then, of course, there's the matter of how well you understand what you're seeing. All right, let me say this right off the top. It doesn't matter. Or rather, it doesn't matter in the way that you think it does. How well you understand the original idea isn't the issue. It's how well it moves within your head. You're not being tested on your comprehension in a classroom setting. You're being asked to move out into the world and make something new. Let me give you an example. Years ago, I was beginning work on a project that would eventually become something to food about. I knew a little bit about the food world, but I wasn't an expert, and I thought I wanted to be. To that end, I spent hours looking around the internet for food stories of all kinds. One of the stories I ran across was about a Japanese scientist who was developing ways to help people grow fresh vegetables in their cramped urban apartments. People before him had experimented with rooftop gardening, but not everyone had rooftops. They had also experimented with closet grow rooms, but those ended up being used for different kinds of plant life. Actually, in Japan, that's probably rare. I remember when I was little and Paul McCartney got busted for weed at the Tokyo airport. He was in jail for 9 days. I wonder if they kept him that extra one just to prevent all the headlines. But this scientist I was reading about had another idea. He developed a kind of special plastic wrap that was loaded with nutrients. He dropped a seed on top of it, added a little water, and went to bed. And before you knew it, the plant was budding right there on the plastic wrap. It was like transparent soil. That's all I know about it. I don't remember the guy's name. I don't remember exactly how it worked. I don't remember if it was a prototype or something that he was selling or something that he was giving away to urban Japanese and people in other developing countries. Mostly what I remember is the thoughts that it put in my own head. I was thinking about plastic wrap, and then wrap. And then I was thinking about the seed taking hold on the sheet by putting down roots. And then I was thinking about the roots. For me, the plastic wrap became a metaphor of how your creative environment didn't have to be obtrusive. It could be as subtle as a transparent sheet, but that was just the first metaphor. Where it really helped me was the next time I started to work on a record. I had the idea somewhere far in the back of my head that the best way to be creative was to set up a kind of invisible barrier that would catch and nurture ideas. That's how I collected rhythmic ideas and how I approached Tariq about his new lyrics. The original idea was only a thing hanging on the wall that I saw for a minute. Remember, the minute of viewing means that it's one of the important ones. It wasn't a 5-second skim. A minute went with my Quinto set. My plastic rap minute was a little different. The first was associative thinking built on the back of observation. The second was a kind of exploration built on the back of poor understanding. I'm not ashamed of it. I wasn't in it to provide a full account of how seed-encouraging saran wrap works in modern-day Japan. Why would I be? I was in it to understand how that process and that produce might profitably interact with my own processes and products. You're both curator of this exhibit and the first and possibly only visitor. You have dual responsibilities, like Alexander Hamilton, whoever that is. How your best self might be your worst enemy. I want to issue a caution about curation. You're always curating your life. That's true. I've noticed a disturbing trend. I'm not the only one. Everyone has noticed it. It came to a head during the 2016 presidential election, when people started to voice their opinion and make themselves known primarily through their online presence. The online world is all about curation, but it's a deceptive version of that principle. You get to present for people your best face, your best look, your best day. Everyone becomes a product, a package. And the reason is that we're all afraid of not getting attention. And the way you get attention is by positioning yourself in a way so that you get it. There are obvious versions of this, and it seems almost silly to attack them. Teen starlets who post filtered duck lip pictures, or politicians who pander to whoever the last person was to contact them on Twitter. There are apps that now let you change your on-screen face in real time before you take selfies. This can't be helped. People who are purely presentational will remain that way. I'm more worried about the effect on creative people. The goal of creativity may be to present yourself to others in part, but it's not to present yourself at the expense of the truth. The second you become your own product, you're heading down a chute rather than up a ladder. I'll give you an example, but I won't say who I'm talking about because I don't mean to attack anyone. There's an artist I know. She's either a musical artist or an author or a painter. That's how vague I'm going to be. She was always introverted and quiet. She kept to herself. If you asked her for opinion on politics, she wouldn't tell you. If you asked her what she was reading, she wouldn't tell you. It was frustrating to try to draw her out. Then, in the age of Twitter, something changed. Suddenly, alarmingly, she started posting pictures of her food and linking to her Goodreads reviews. Early on in this transformation, I felt happy for her. I'm a shy person myself in some ways, and I know it can be painful. And I like seeing her come out of her shell. But then at some point, it became a problem. I heard that she wasn't doing as much work. The business of orienting herself or presenting herself as a product had become, in fact, her work. This may sound a little hypocritical, and with any luck, it is. I use social media as much as anyone. I'm tweeting all the time, Instagramming too, but I'm careful, if not always successful, about making sure that it doesn't step on my work. I also like to show warts. Not literally, I mean, that'd be gross. But I like to show the entirety of my human experience. Sometimes that means I blunder and I speak out of turn. I've offended people who thought a joke I made was inconsiderate or flirted with broad stereotypes. Look it up. But I don't like the idea of the internet scrubbing that all away. I also live in a world that proves this point a second time. The world of show business. Every day before The Tonight Show goes on air, we get hair and makeup. I wake up beautiful, of course, but beauty needs a hand to move it along. I get work on hair, skin, and nails. They know that a camera's going to be on me and that millions and millions of people will be watching. Not even just watching, scrutinizing. Technology has allowed people to see the tiniest details. So now that's what we focus on, the tiniest details. On TV, it's visual scrutiny via HDTV. On the internet, it might be a typo, but the principle is the same. When we focus on those tiny details, we lose sight of the larger issues. We just do. It's just the way it goes. And when it comes to making art, both of them have to be working hand in hand. You need to think of small things, no question. You need to be able to get that pitch down symbol just right. But as I've said 100 times in 100 other ways, just right isn't necessarily about flawlessness. It's about other flaws. It's about letting that sound go a little flat or a little wobbly, about letting it carry humanity. The era of curation, which is the era we're in, the time of picking, which is the time that we're in, is not an excuse to selectively edit our humanity or show the world a happy face or a fresh face or a put-together face that doesn't have much, if anything, to do with our essential real identity. Rant done for now. Stand your ground and stick to your guns. DJing may be the purest form of curation. It affords you the opportunity to build a collage of the world's sounds. I tend toward the arty end of the spectrum and toward the black arty end. My whole stance towards modernized commercial music is that I love it. I'm unashamed to love it. I love Drake. I love Future. I love Migos. I like Earl Sweatshirt, Logic, Kendrick, Cardi, Chance. Drum might be my favorite new belter in hip-hop since ODB. I'm wide open. I'm not a snob about anything that's on the charts, but I'm also devoted to exploring the connections between the different parts of music, national and international. American and British, rock and soul, and punk and funk, and folk and 90s, and 80s and 70s, and before. I'm aware of enough connections that can demonstrate that you can play Duke Ellington and Remy Ma and Led Zeppelin and Millie Jackson, and it could work all together. It's like string lights, or the opposite. When you illuminate one light on the thread, they all go on together. I build all the music I have into mega sets. I clean up and refine. I shuffle songs and polish up the whole set. Usually around March of each year, I start cleaning out my DJ set. I look at the new music I put in there, think about the music that hasn't changed for more than a year, tighten pacing, calibrate. I also try to arrange it to accommodate new things I've noticed about crowd habits. For example, a few years ago, I started putting in power boosters just before hour marks. When people are out at the club, they look at their watches as the time draws near to midnight, and again, when it draws near to 1 a.m. That's when they're thinking about paying the babysitter and getting enough sleep for work. So that's when I hit them with the killer record. It obliterates the whole idea of leaving. They never even make it to the coat room. I keep them another hour, at which time I can give them another killer record. This past year, cleaning out and tightening my DJ set took on an entirely different meaning. To explain, I have to go back to the presidential election of 2008. During that time, the Roots were campaigning for Barack Obama. We agreed with his political stances, and it wasn't only that. We connected at some deeper level without ever meeting in person. The more I saw him, the more I knew I wanted to share music with him. He was so smart, so receptive to the way that American culture worked, so interested in the intellectual links between things. I started sourcing and collecting songs like crazy, and they evolved into these elaborate playlists. Evening chill music, spooning in bed music, up to beat the world music. What you were listening to while you were eating or while you were reading a book. I knew that if it was music to chill by, you wouldn't want loud drums or too much screaming. I had it all worked out. I programmed an iPod with special music on it for